Very happy to welcome today Kev McDonough from Rotunda Films.
Hello.
Kev, how are you?
Hello. All right.
New surroundings, so if it looks a bit different and we look like we're sitting at a very big table in very small chairs, we are a little bit.
Is that Alice in Wonderland?
Yeah. So, Kev, you got a lot of involvement in around Birmingham, filmmaking, industry as a whole at the moment. We'll go into that and what you've kind of done and what you're doing shortly, but could you give us a brief introduction to your good self?
So I'm Kerry McDonough. I'm the president of the Birmingham Film Festival, which is about to have its ninth edition in its current version that we set up. Over the last 20-something years, I've worked in film and television predominantly as a director, but as a writer and producer and lighting and every other job, because, you know, a lot of it's low budget stuff and you've got to do a bit of everything. I've made some badass sandwiches and written TV shows and, like I say, directed commercials, music videos, and kind of just sort of made a career working in the industry pretty much as a gun for hire on whatever job that is, as a freelancer, which is, I think, what most people do, but then also having your own business with your own projects and your own sort of ambitions to end up somewhere. And now I've found myself running for the last decade the city's only, I was gonna say the only international film festival. The city's only proper film festival that is open to all, with no theme or no restrictions. We are the city's film festival.
Okay. No small thing. It's good to so at the moment obviously there's all the work going on, the development isn't that around here, back a big but
yeah, fans, isn't that? Since we started the festival, there's always been this, things are coming to Birmingham, things are coming, you know, things are going to happen. And this is the first time it's kind of felt real. Like, when we started the festival, the big thing that was going on is they were shooting Ready Player One.
Yeah.
And they still go on about it. They were here for, what, like 5-6 weeks?
When we went down, didn't we, and watched the Spielberg
thing. And, you know, everyone was like, oh, man, maybe there's some jobs in it for us. And I'm like, no, there's no jobs for it. They're coming into town, they're going to do their thing. But it's good for the industry to demonstrate that the city can support that. And then it just seemed to be every year kept going on. And we're like, yeah, but they have Ready Player One and they shot 8 seconds of Kingsman 2. And it always felt like it was a false dawn. But now with the three facilities being built, the Beeb, the Bond and Digbeth Lock, and the companies that are moving in that are legitimate production companies, yeah, predominantly come out straight out of London and now moved up here for whatever their reasons are.
Yeah,
it feels now like there's an opportunity for an industry to get a foothold, which is really what we've needed, because we've got loads of young talent and the amount of it. I had to do it as well. I worked for Channel 4. I had to commute to London every day to have a job in television that wasn't even the most satisfying of jobs. I mean, I like doing it, but
yeah,
the career progression was minimal. So I had to step out of that and I was back to square one to a certain extent. So having those jobs in the region now is really important, especially from our point of view, where what we do is more of the sort of, it's the fun element of it. Making a film is the fun goal that everyone wants to do.
Yeah.
But that can only sustain so long if people haven't got a job. Yeah. So yeah, it's great that finally there's some real sort of foundation for an industry around it.
Yeah,
you got the inside scoop then, kind of what's going on with all these companies, because still seems to be under wraps, doesn't it? Some sort of Stephen Knight and stuff.
There's a little bit of that, but I think some of that's down to the fact they don't know 100% what's going to happen. From what I've heard, and none of it's like secret, don't tell anyone, but from what we've heard and sort of had conversations about, there's three or four of the fairly, I think Optimum's coming here, North One. And Kudos are obviously established because Stevens, Kudos Knight is Stevens' company. So they're all established in either Digbeth Lock or the Bond. The Beeb are renovating what is currently, I think there's like Bournemouth Unis in it or something. It's the old tea factory, whichever one it was. So the Beeb are moving into this. They're obviously going to vacate the mailbox, which they never should have been put into. They should have stayed at Pebble Mill.
But, I know, yeah.
You know. Who'd have thought a nice big facility outside the city's clean air zone would have been useful, but whatever. So with the Beeb moving in, that's going to put a lot of full-time positions, and then the amount of crew that are based in the city but have to work out should, in theory, have lots of opportunities to work from somewhere less than 30 miles from their house. So if that all does follow through as they have planned, then it should lead to more companies seeing it as an opportunity. Like, you can go to Brom, there's office space, there's workspace, there's tons of...
HS2.
All of that. Mm. Yeah, HS2 is going to make it a lot easier. The execs will still all be based in London. The head offices will all be based in... They might scale down. And then Brom will be like a production floor, like a factory floor for a lot of it, because it's half the price. There's loads of locations unseen. And there's loads of talent. Being in the middle, it's really easy for you to get to. I was chatting to a guy who runs a production company in Stratford. And he'd got a job on that. While I was down in Stratford, he had a job on in Birmingham. He said half my crews had to come from Bristol because we couldn't get the people in Brom because they're all out working outside of Brom because they have to. So, yeah, it should mean that there's a homegrown community hub that all the talent, and particularly all the film schools, that, you know, there's a couple of film schools not far from out.
Yep.
They're all their first screening film schools, first graduation lot are out now. They've just finished. They should all have some opportunities to work and stay in the city and not, as I had to do, jump on a train and go to London and pay £8 for a sandwich every lunchtime.
Yeah. So, talking of that, where you started, take it back then. So, Bourneville College.
Cadbury College. I'm sure that was in your notes and you got it wrong.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to be smart by glancing at the notes and not reading them religiously. It's a guide. But, yeah, so college, where was the initial drive to become a director, to be involved in film? Where did that come from?
I thought I wanted to be an actor. I even did drama at A level and did a couple of plays, and I'd done like school plays and this, that and the other. And then something just clicked in my head and I was more interested in telling the whole story than just playing a piece of it. Plus, I was probably too ugly to be an actor. Like, I probably really was too unattractive to be an actor. So it's much better.
There might be a remake. What's it with Rocky Dennis in what?
Mask.
Mask.
Oh. So, I'll just see, I've aged out of it. Now, if anything, it'd be the Cher role. And I think I'm probably better looking than Cher.
Yeah, I agree.
And so then I got into production. And then when I went to college, I did media, business, and drama. So, still sort of clinging on to doing it. And then, really cleverly, what I did was I failed my A levels, and that was a brilliant move.
Tactics.
Because it meant I couldn't go to university.
Okay.
Which meant I had to go and get a job. So I had about, I think I had like 8-9 months just sort of bumming around, went and did a couple of crappy jobs. Like, went on holiday to see some mates, and because you know, after college, some blowout to go and enjoy myself. And then I ended up working for a production company in Selly Oak with one of the worst producers I have ever worked with.
Name names.
Oh, fuck it, Neil Jackson. He was an absolute dickhead. And he was trying to... Although my first ever paid directing job working with Neil, we went to some sci-fi convention in Manchester and we were interviewing Ray Harryhausen and Forrest J. Ackerman. Obviously, Ray Harryhausen did all the stop motion monster effects in loads of those sort of, in all the Jason Yardenauts films and all of that. And he'd only ever been interviewed about, this is how unlucky I am, 3 or 4 times he'd ever been interviewed. We had a BBC crew coming in to come and shoot it for us, and we were just boots on the ground and the crew didn't show up. So I had to set up this director, never directed an interview, never done a talking head. There was some Italian horror film director came in. I set up this terrible interview set up against the wall with a lamp between the interviewer and this director, filmed this terror. He didn't speak English, so there was a French guy who spoke Italian to ask the questions and then translated back to us. It was absolute garbage, like really badly lit. And then just as we were getting ready to interview Ray Harryhausen, this BBC crew showed up and they said, what is this, like, stripped it apart and rebuilt this two-header interview. And the guy who, I can't remember his name now, the guy who was running the crew for us, in one afternoon taught me how to do talking head interviews with the like BBC stuff. I said, set this, put that there, blah, blah, blah. And I sat there and watched it, and then he says, go on, and you can do it now. And he let me run the rest of the interview and direct the rest of the shoot. So I got to direct Ray Harryhausen. Wow. And it was brilliant. And off the back of that, this Neil was trying to make a low-budget horror movie, which was about a giant fish in Lake Windermere. And it's actually based on a book. I think the book was written by Peter Bletchley as well, who wrote Jaws. It's called The Pike. So it was about a giant 20-foot gar pike in Lake Windermere. So we went to Earlswood to shoot.
As you do.
Day one of the shoot, we go in to get all the kit and the equipment, and this guy's meant to be directing it. He says, oh, I can't come on the shoot, I've got some work to do. So he sends me, one of the actors who is now assistant director, and another one of the production team, to go out and film his movie for him. Like, what? Just gave us like 6 pages, go and film that. So we go up to Earlswood, and he said, you've got to be done by 6 o'clock because I've sold one of the cameras on eBay and the guy's coming to collect it this evening. Yeah. So I was like, I'm learning a lot of what not to do at this point.
Yeah.
And then a couple of weeks went by. It was an absolute joke of a production. And then the thing that bust the back of it for me, and when I was like, I'm out, was when I showed up and he'd had the fish built. So we've got police search boats as well. So I was like, because one of this camera guy I've got who's coming on, he's a deep sea diver and he can do all this. And I showed up and they were basically two large inflatable dinghies. Oh, he's like, well, we'll put an outboard motor on the back of it. Like, that thing's just going to sink. and like, we're pumping up with foot pumps. I'm like, what is going on here? And then he showed me, so I've got the shark head or the fish head, the pike head. And I showed up, and I ain't even joking, it was a paper mache fish head on a broom handle. I was like, how are you? He goes, well, the guy in the scuba suit will be underwater and he was popping up just like in Jaws, mate.
It's like, yeah, I mean,
just like in Jaws.
Was he like, oh yeah, we don't see the monsters at the end of Jaws?
I mean, he legit thought he'd outsmarted the industry. So me and one of the actors who'd worked on that, who'd worked with him, we were so disillusioned. He'd been working on another film down in Hereford called Soul Searcher, directed by Neil Osman. He said, Neil needs some help, come and help me. We went down, he was doing some pickups, and Neil had a bit of a stress putting this film together. He'd worked really hard to get it done. And me and AJ, the actor I was with, we'd sacked off this other fish film, sitting in the pub going, I reckon we could make a movie. I reckon we could do this, like, absolutely nothing. Literally do for nothing. Like, people are idiots. Like, listen, Neil's struggling here. He's been making a polystyrene fish up the road, like, let's go do it. So we went off, we wrote a screenplay. I established Rotunda Films as a production company, and we went and made what was effectively my first movie, which was Idol of Evil, which is a complete Indiana Jones knockoff.
I watched it, it's good.
It's all right. The first half is totally Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
The second half is Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. But we came out 2 years before Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, so me and Spielberg decided not
just
to sue each other. Yeah. Yeah, we went, you know.
Mutual.
Yeah, mutual destruction. And that was it then. From there, it was, I had a foot in the industry where I had conversations I could have with people about stuff, and you start meeting people and you start working with people and you get recommendations. Went and made another movie after that, produced a film, did some commercials, music videos, and then it just becomes the day-to-day. And literally, I never stopped working in the film industry. I'd had some other work, you know, I had done some other sort of day jobs, but they were all sort of adjacent to the industry. I'd worked as in graphic design at one point and things like that. But from then on, it was full time working in film and television.
Is that for with your bro, David?
Yeah. He had a signage and graphic design business, so I got to do lots of sort of sign installation. I think there's loads of stuff around the city that I'd installed with the gaffer, and it was up for years. I'm like, stuck up, it's still there. We did loads of stuff down the football, like, we used to do big.
You're telling to your dad every time you go past, you go, awesome.
No, he was like, maybe you should knock this filmmaking on the head and get back into, you know, plastering and decorating if you're so good at sticking up posters. Yeah. We did loads of stuff at the football grounds they used to do. It was great when the Baggies kept getting promoted and relegated, because every time the Baggies got relegated, the TV, the digital advertising screens got stripped and had to put all the big Firmex boards up, so we'd go and put them up. And then when they got promoted, all that stuff had to come down. So we'd go take every couple of years, we'd go back and just, hanging off the rafters.
That did yo-yo, didn't that?
Oh, yeah. We did all right out of that. And then I quit. I went full-time for the last time about 10 years ago. And
did you get any pressure? Was there any pressure at the time? Obviously, starting out, trying to establish yourself. Like you say, you told, well, when do you get back into kind of stick to the trade, consistent work? Was there ever any of that? Or
not really, because I wasn't good at anything else. Like, legitimately, like, there's nothing. I mean, if I didn't make film now, I do not know what I'd do for a living, because I have no other skill set. I'm all right with Excel, that's about it. But I couldn't go into anything else. I'd done some computer engineering, just before I made my first film, when I was working for the production company in Selly Oak, I worked at Birmingham Uni, so it was like two little part-time jobs, one in film and one in, and working in computers meant I was able to build edit suites and learn how that will work. All that information that I don't know, I don't know what any of it is. So no, I'm stuck doing this for the next
Leaving editing suites these days, they're moving on so fast, aren't they?
It's mad.
Have you got the Creative Cloud now with all the AI stuff?
Yeah, and it's terrifying.
Yeah,
and
I was going to come on to that AI in film, in the rain film, because it's quite a hot potato at the
minute. Better get onto it quick before, because
it's outdated.
I mean, my iPhone will be out of date by the time I leave as well. It's not...
Well, we can do that one next then, so as we're on it. So yeah, AI being quite a big hot potato discussion at the moment in film and the film industry. There was Light Not With The Devil came out, didn't it? An independent film rather than big pat on the back. They got dug out all over social medias, didn't they, for using AI images in a couple of scenes. And to be fair, when you watch the film, you can see... Did you notice where they actually were in the film?
Yeah.
When the actual logo has come up in between on the ad breaks.
Right.
Watch it back and you'll see where it is. But yeah, so obviously the film came out to acclaim, but then they've been dug out on the internet and within the industry for using that. So where do you stand? Put your flag in the sand now. How do you feel about AI in film? Using AI, would you use it? Do you use it? Will you use it?
I would use it. I don't think it will ever replace... I know this is quite a trite answer, but I don't think it'll ever replace creativity, because it's referencing stuff other people have done. And once the percentage of AI content is out there that's higher than original content, it's just going to be self-perpetuating. It's just going to fall apart. But we've been using, to a certain extent, like we're talking about editing software, and you look at something like After Effects or even Premiere Pro, keyframing, you pick your two keyframes, the computer figures out the movement, that is effectively AI.
Letting the computer do the job.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much of it that's already involved. I think where people are worried is that it's going to come up with the ideas and the concepts, and
people will just let run with it and just be like, yeah. Okay.
And to a certain extent, it will. You can get AI images generated, but again, they're based on stuff other people have already made. So it's always going to need those new ideas to... You always need a bit of chlorine in the gene pool, don't you, to keep things going otherwise.
Some of these videos now, the viral videos, I think you sent that Biden one earlier, but like there was Gareth Southgate ones during the Euros and stuff. They're so clever, aren't they? And they're seamless. And there's some of that scene as well that's handy for us, for interviews and stuff now, that you can put in, okay, speak German, and it'll change the way they speak.
It is scary. It's useful, but I think it will... I ain't overly worried about it. One, I'm so old that it's probably not going to matter. But where I think AI is going to land and find its final place in the world is just commercials. I think just like everything else in the film industry, like, I remember 100 years ago, you didn't have to put credits on films. And then systems were put in place where you've got to credit everybody, you've got to do it. And AI will fall into that category. If you've used AI in this film, you've got to credit it. You've got to acknowledge where it's been used. The unions will be... I mean, they went on strike for best part of a year and got most of what they wanted. So they're not going to stand for it.
Mm.
But in the long run, I don't think it benefits. But in terms of doing commercials, British Airways want a shot of a plane flying over New York. It's a lot easier to just go British Airways 747.
Yeah.
And that's where it'll end up. It's where the most money can be saved, and commercials are expensive and they generate a lot of income. So if you, instead of spending $3 million on a commercial, you can spend $60,000 and a laptop. That's where it will go. The rest of the film industry, it beat television. Well, it competed with television. It competed with the internet. It still survived. The only reason it feels worse at the moment is because we're still coming out of COVID accelerated the streaming platforms, and they're all going to... I personally think we're going to lose at least one of the big ones in the next 18 months.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if it was Disney Plus.
Right.
I think Disney... I might be proven wrong. I didn't think Netflix was going to win the wars, but Netflix is winning it with old TV shows. I think Netflix is probably a year away from having a randomised button where you select all your favourite shows, like, you know, put on my random list, and then just play random episodes. So there's The Office, there's the Parks and Rec, or whatever it is. There's Rick and Morty. And then Netflix will randomly show stuff that you like, kind of like television does. And Netflix is just going to burn.
It's already, they've already slipped the same with Prime, isn't it? They've already started with the adverts in the middle of the programmes and the film. So it is essentially, the idea was you went there because you just wanted to watch a film. I pay £6 a month for this. I want to watch a film straight through. Now all of a sudden, you got a 1 minute advert in the middle of the film. Can't skip it. I'm sure there's a premium option where you pay another £3.
Yeah, of course.
You can skip it. Or you...
And Disney will probably never jump into that advert model. And that's what will create a lot of pressure for them, because they're going to produce such expensive stuff. But yeah, we had 10, 15 years ago, we had YouTube or television, and then Netflix and all that come along. And now they're both, they're splitting. Like, you can have a YouTube experience on Netflix, or you can have a television experience on Netflix. And they'll just split. What will be left in the middle then is those streamers can't afford to spend the sort. Beverly Hills Cop 4, not a cheap movie, and probably would have made them 200 million if it had gone to the box office. But they straight onto streaming. Those days won't last, because it's expensive to spend probably about 100 million to make that movie just to keep people on your Netflix account.
I think TV will die first. Just kind of terrestrial and satellite, maybe.
Possibly. I mean, it's whether it's an age thing that, you know, our folks probably still predominantly watch terrestrial television. And, you know, my folks are retired, so, you know, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, whatever it is, Pointless comes on. And there's not much of a, you don't really go home and go, oh, I miss Pointless, let's see if I got it on catch up. So whilst that generation's still around, live television's probably the thing that'll keep broadcasters going for, say, a decade. But yeah, people are now expect to be able to pick what they want to watch when they want to watch it, regardless of how old it is. And there's only so much of that business that can be sustained when you've got, whatever it is, 15 streamers at the moment, like Tubi's started to promote Plex, all of that. There's only so much business around. And the advantage of television has always been the BBC. I know people complain about the licence fee. I haven't got a problem paying the licence fee, because the BBC makes something for everybody. ITV's deal was, watch these adverts and you ain't got to pay for it. And then people started getting TV with no adverts that they had to pay for. And the fact that now they're offering you an alternative means that model doesn't work anymore, because Netflix is like, we can't afford to keep doing this without adverts, or at least Amazon Prime can't afford to keep running without charging you extra to not watch adverts. So, but in terms of AI, that was your original question, I think it's commercials. I don't think it's ever going to take over the creative process.
Okay. Oh, okay.
But now, go on, we'll go through IMDb and see what made any sense.
To be fair, I wasn't going to run you through a list of the films and things on there anyway, because again, you've got credits for writing, directing, producing, acting. Like you say,
Extracting?
I think there was, what's the name of the film? I worked on a film up in Yorkshire, and I was the assistant gaffer. I ended up being the gaffer, because the gaffer was the DB. And it was this mystery film about a plot to take over the world by Milkman. And these four characters who all have crap going on in their life team together and accidentally form a detective agency and solve the crime. And the way they've done it is you never saw who the killer was. It was always a glove and a hand and this, that and the other. And by the end of production, they'd used everybody in the crew for the final reveal. And I was the only person who hadn't been in the film, whose face hadn't been seen somewhere else. So I had to be the villain at the end of it. That's giving me a haircut and everything. So big shaggy.
Cat mustard.
And we were filming. It was really good, actually. We were filming outside this guy's cat mustard. We were filming outside the director's house. And he had this white Toyota something or other. And they wanted to use it as the police car. And the plan was to just see the roof. Really low sports car thing. And he bought one of those, you know, like the old Bill credit.
Sorry,
a coffee cup type thing. And that was going to go on the roof and be the... So we're going to see that, us in the background, a couple of people dressed up as coppers. And I think the copper uniforms were like bomber jackets bought from Primark with police spray painted on the back or whatever. And... what we'd done is they'd set up one right outside his house. Most of us were in his garden and his car's parked on the street, but we'd set up like a redhead and we'd run a really thin extension cable across the path. One of his neighbours complained about it. So the old Bill shows up. They show up in there flipping 4x4, blues and twos, the lot, all tech, you know, all kitted up. And they're like, what are you doing, lads? And we're getting closed down. It was so, it's like the last couple of shots of the shoot. And the unit photographer, because it was a tiny little town in Yorkshire, knew the copper. So he goes in and says, everyone calm down. I don't have a word with him. Comes back about 4 minutes later and he says, yeah, it's fine. Yeah, 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 it's cool. So we carry on filming. He's gone, no. The copper said they'll be in it. You can use a police car. No. So the movie sports car and the coppers pull the car up, get out, arrest me, cuff me, sling me in the back of the car, drive off. They get the whole scene. They come back and they go, how was that? I mean, yeah, that's brilliant. I go, do you want to do a second take just to be sure? And so we did it again. So just out of nowhere, we got this.
Mint, yeah,
beautiful.
Better than...
So that was, I think that was my last official, I mean, there might have been a couple of other things around the theatre, but that was my last official acting credit, probably.
Well, yeah, so my question really with in regards to the directing. So again, on there, you've got 11 with one in production. But in regards to low budget filmmaking, you've obviously been at various ends of the spectrum now, the time you've been in the industry directing films. What are your kind of budget? What's your budget window for? What's your cheapest that you can make a film? Or what's the most you've spent on a film as a company making independent low budget films?
I mean, it changes. I've learned stuff, and I'd give people slightly different advice. If like right now, if somebody said, "What should I do?" I'd say either make something really, really low budget, or go make it for a sensible, realistic budget in terms of what you can make it for. Because it's very, very tough to go make a film for 100, 200, 300 grand and then see your money back. Like there are people who've done it, but there's so many people who they don't raise that money. They try and shoot it on the cheap, and they end up wasting a load of money and not making anything. But my record is $7,000 was the cheapest, and that was the first film I ever made, and 150 was the next one, and then the one that's just about to come out, I think our final spend was 350. But that was the one that had the biggest problems, and that's the one that got tangled up in COVID and production releases, and because we'd run out of money by the time we came to post, it caused delay after delay after delay, and you know, a bunch of stuff getting lost on a ship on its way to Australia, which is a really annoying story. But that got delayed, so there's a big spend there that's a huge risk, which isn't even a big spend for a film. It's next to nothing for a movie. But once you're tied into that large amount of money, getting that money back is so hard at 300 grand because you can't afford. Can't afford a marquee name. Like, I know people will make films and they'll get so-and-so from Barry from EastEnders or whatever. But they're not queuing up round the block for that. And I've known people get fairly well-known actors attached to their projects for a fee, and it's brought the value of the film down because that person's not a big enough draw to warrant spending that money on them.
So if you're going to dip your toes into a name, you then need to get a level of name, otherwise it works negatively against the film.
You need someone who, for every pound you spend on them, brings in at least £5 at the box office. Right. I'd say anything less than that, and it's a massive gamble because you're going to pay them, and then there's loads of cost that comes with getting them, and you've got to probably adjust your schedule because they'll give you 4 days, and you spend that on the leg to get them there, and you put them up in hotels. And are people really queuing up for Keith Chegwin or whatever?
Yeah.
Nothing against Keith. I mean, I'm sure he's a nice guy.
All will say so. So, we talked about the streaming services. What kind of difference has that made to a filmmaker and a production company in regards to streaming across various medias rather than the traditional route, which was previously showed at independent cinemas, etc.? How does that work for you, and how does it work financially for a company? Is it beneficial?
It doesn't. Like, Netflix will buy your film off you for next to nothing, and they'll have it for almost perpetuity. Like, you won't make your money back. If you make a low-budget movie with your own cash and sell it to Netflix, you will lose money. They don't pay a great deal. I think the streaming platforms, particularly this Amazon Prime Video, has given people a false hope, because Amazon Video is effectively YouTube. but it looks really nice having an Amazon logo, and I've done it myself. The one sitcom that I shot, we're uploading the entire series to Amazon Prime because it's free for us to do it. It gets out to an audience, and it looks a lot better having the Amazon logo. It's still Stoptics. Amazon looks better than YouTube as your logo for your poster.
Yeah, more prestigious.
But you're not going to make any money out of it.
No.
Unless those streamers are commissioning your film, selling it to them becomes the job of a sales agent if you can get one for your film, and they need to be out there battling for the best deal around the world in every territory. Chances are, if you've made a movie for 50 grand, your sales agent is not busting their back to get the best deal. They'll take whatever deal because they get their 10-15%, whatever it is. So I think it's given people a bit of false hope in terms of making money, but it encourages people to go out and make stuff, and that's really the most important part of all it. You can make money in the film industry, you can make money in the low-budget film industry, but I think really you have to enjoy it more than anything. And if you don't make a penny off making your films, but you have a really good time and enjoy it and you've been creative, I think that's a win.
Mm. And it's all self-publicising, isn't it, these days? It's become very... what's the word? It's become easier to put your stuff out there and hoping it grabs a bit of attention while not spending a lot of money, really. There's a lot of free resources out there to put it out there, i.e. TikTok and like you say, with that Amazon thing, then that might be prestigious enough then to be like, okay, we've got something on Amazon Prime that give you a bit of a sales kind of edge.
If nothing else, another filmmaker might see what you've done and say, hey, I'm working on this.
Do you fancy getting involved?
Yeah, I got a little bit of money to pay out. And then you've earned enough money to keep doing the thing that you want to do. And it might, you know, you're in the game at least. It might be the thing that gets you to that level of directing, you know, the next Star Wars movie, if you've got the ability and this, that, and the other. But it's unlikely to rocket you to stardom as a filmmaker.
Is that the unicorn that everyone aspires to? Is that the... Because you had your associate in COVID lockdown, didn't you? Who made a film and now...
Oh, he made Host, didn't he? Rob Savage.
Oh, yeah.
So it's gone from... But he made Strings before that, didn't he? And a few other things. And he's like... His niche was... He was like 17 when he was making them. So that's his sell.
Overnight success takes 10 years. Mm. But even Hollywood's the same. You know, at the moment, Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney are the big stars of everything. And who's the other? Austin Butler. Mm. And they're all the big names. So they seem to have come out of nowhere. I was watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood the other day. Sydney Sweeney and Austin Butler are both in it.
Yeah.
Glenn Powell's in The Dark Knight Rises. It's like... None of these people have just... And it's the same with filmmakers. If you look... The one thing IMDb is good for is if you look at some big-name directors, not even big-name directors, successful directors who are working on... There's a lot of films that you probably like that you can't remember, no idea who directed them. But if you look at their career, they've worked through a lot of stuff, and it's the experience and the contacts. And then IMDb will demonstrate to you very few people have come in on their first day, made a short film and then rocketed to the top.
Yeah.
It can happen.
Yeah.
But with so many people putting stock in that being their only route, 10 years down the line when they haven't been rocketed to stardom, and I made that mistake to a certain extent, you've lost the opportunity to become a better filmmaker and a better industry member and learn much more that makes you useful, that gets you more opportunities, that helps you climb that ladder, because people are trying to jump across the canyon rather than climbing down, swimming across the river, climbing the other side. They want to get across
instant
it.
Instant gratification.
Yeah, and it's really tough to do. And I think the streaming platforms, YouTube came along and started, well, the digital revolution came along and started, hey, look, cameras are cheap and anyone can make a movie. The downside is anyone can make a movie. And then YouTube came along and helped really sort of promote people's work. And then the streamers have come along and hey, we can kind of do the same thing. I don't think that's necessarily true. You see on TikTok is where people can blow up there. And that's a completely different format to film. It's still creative, but yeah, I think the streamers have, I hate to say it, I think they're just in it for the money, and there's no scope for creatives to really get them. Netflix is not there to help bolster your career. Mm. It's what to do when you're out of work.
It's polarising, even with like Martin Scorsese, the to and throwing around like the MCU films and Netflix and streaming. But then The Irishman went onto Netflix, didn't it?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, what side of the fence are you on with the arguments? And then how much money must that have thrown at Martin Scorsese then to
I mean, say, okay, cinema is sacred, but my new film's going on Netflix.
I think you probably... If you're going to throw money at a filmmaker and let them do whatever they want, Martin Scorsese is probably one of the few, probably the five filmmakers on the planet. Mm-hmm. You can say, go make whatever you want. We know people will like it.
With no pressure, just on that. Who are the five?
I reckon it's probably Scorsese, Spielberg, Nolan, Tarantino, and then, I mean, dealer's choice, are probably Cameron. James Cameron are the five that, whatever they make, it's newsworthy. And all their films are fairly well known. Like, there's a handful of Spielberg films you'll probably go, oh yeah, I forgot he directed Munich. But outside of that, I don't think Netflix did it in order to say, hey, we want to just invest in an artistic venture. It's like, we'll buy this Scorsese product and everyone will watch it.
Is that a muscle flex? Is that Netflix saying, actually, we can do this, we can...
I don't even think the streamers think that way. I think it's purely... It was another reason why I've always made sure I'm good with Excel. It's a numbers game. They're like, we invest this much in a Scorsese movie, we predict we'll get this many extra... We'll retain this many... like customers, will gain this many customers, that'll turn out to be worth X amount over their lifetime because X amount of people stay for X amount of months, blah, blah, blah. We'll make that money back within 3 years.
So just on that, you talk about the numbers and how important the numbers are, especially with Netflix. What do you make of the numbers on the films? Like, it's a big thing online, isn't it, about there's no way these numbers are real. A Jennifer Lopez film comes out and it's the most streamed, and these films coming out that no one claims to have watched, but they've got a billion streams. Netflix claims it's the most watched film in the last 20 years. Where do you stand on that? Is that an accurate depiction of what's actually going on, or have they got some kind of loophole?
I mean, maybe I can't off the top of my head think, because they don't have advertisers.
Red, for example.
Oh, yeah. Red Notice, whatever it was. Yeah. It's the most...
Red Notice, wasn't it? Yeah.
I don't personally know, but this is only out there. I don't know how many... Anyone who, having heard about how amazing Red Notice was, decided I must get Netflix. They also don't have advertisers yet, so I don't, unless it's part of their ramp up to an advertising model, to say, look at the numbers we're getting, look how many people you'll reach. That's the only reason, if they're inflating their numbers, they would do it. If they are inflating their numbers, they're doing it the same way television's been doing it for years. You watch for 30 seconds and it counts as a view. And for every one person in the country watching, they class it as 1,000.
Probably even them previews that you get now.
Because have you noticed if you look at the film, it starts playing it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you click play, particularly if it's at the start of an episode or a film, it'll just carry on. There's no pause, there's no reset to the logo. It just goes. They're probably counting that as a view.
I would assume so, yeah.
If I was in their advertising sales department, I would absolutely be doing that. How many people watch this? Oh, a lot.
Yeah, and Red Notice, it's got this many. So you have a little look at the preview, then that counts as a view.
Yeah, it is funny because I don't know a single person's watched it, even though so you think, okay, that many people have watched it. And then you ask your friends and family and no one's seen it.
And Netflix doesn't have... Maybe they do have access to the Barb numbers and the Nielsen ratings, where how many people... I had a meeting with someone from Sky Advertising and they revealed some really shocking things to me. Nothing like terrifying. I was like, oh my God. Your Nectar card is grassing you up to Sky and telling you who you are, what you buy, what you watch, what you're into, so that they can determine which advertising to pump through the Sky box.
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised if Netflix are accessing that and go, right, here's a household, it's got six people in it. They're all, you know, three of them are over 18. These are the viewing habits. We can assume that 50% of that household are watching it. So if one person watches 30 seconds of Red Notice, maybe they're saying, oh yeah, that's three people watched Red Notice. Whereas really that was just flicking through. Couldn't figure out how to turn it over to Sky Sports to watch the F1.
Yeah.
But
it's buying a ticket, isn't it? Or ticket sales of this many people literally sat down and watched it.
Which is strange that film box office is the only industry that's judged on the amount of money made, not tickets sold. Television is number of viewers. Concerts, how many people showed up. It might took, you know, Taylor Swift has made billions, but they will always tell you how many people attended. Football, second to the score, is usually the attendance. The number one record in the top 10 was always number one record. Listen to me. The number one. The greatest.
Oh, records.
Yeah. Too young. The number one MP3. Even MP3s are out there.
Yeah.
The number one downloaded fresh tune.
You're so tired with the kids.
Man, I was bumping into the furniture trying to be trendy then. That's always been on number of sales. Film's the only one where it's how much money did this movie make? And then you're, because then you're adjusted for inflation. Well, then it's a stupid model. How many people went to see it?
Yeah.
Particularly when you got stuff like, you know, Meerkat offering 2-for-1 and Orange Wednesdays we used to have and stuff like
that. And it'd be easy to work out, wouldn't it?
Of course it would. I think you've got all that
in your Excel spreadsheet.
I don't play Champ Manager. I'm Excelling all night long.
Yeah.
So there was a clip of Kevin Costner talking at a conference, like a convention, a couple of weeks ago, and Waterworld came up, and he's quite touchy about it.
Defensive, isn't
he? What he was saying, the whole time it was being made, it was always going to be 120, 130 million, but the film company came out and told the press that it was going to be a 100 million film. So he then said, now I've got to deal with, not only is it the most expensive film ever, you know, flop. No, it's going to be more than that. But we already know that. Well, you've told me it's going to be this, so I've got to cop heat now for that, and then I'm going to get the flack then when it goes over. So when it, at the actual start, the origin of the film and putting budgets together, they knew it was going to be $120 to $130 million, but the hung him out to dry on the it's $100 million.
That's straight, because that news story probably put, oh, he's making all that money. I don't know, watch that. There'll be people who literally would not want to go and watch it because, oh, he's wasted all that money making, I'm going to go and watch that. Whereas Titanic, which was kind of the same situation, it was 100 and something million. People, they didn't make that sound like a negative.
Yeah.
It's strange that we judge films based on how much money they make, not how many people went to see it.
I quite like Waterworld.
It's all right. It probably made its money. Not its same,
it stigmatised, wasn't it? And then even now.
It's a bit culty.
Films that he's making now, again, the longer films, aren't they? He's self-funding them. Well, Francis Ford Coppola, isn't it, with this megalopolis? Yeah. He's had to self-fund it because he couldn't raise the money.
It's mad. I mean, he was probably, up until recently, he'd have been in that five. Up until maybe about 10 years ago, you'd have put Coppola in that five that can do whatever they want. But he's had to, it took him 10 years to raise the money for Wolf of Wall Street. Like, it's
this whole story beyond it in itself, isn't it?
It is strange the way that, you know, it is judged on how much money it made. And I bet you Waterworld made its money back in the long run. When it's been on TV loads, it was on DVD, loads of people. It's probably one of the first movies that was about when DVD kicked off in 97, 98. It's probably one of the first DVD movies that had all the special features and a big long apology from Kevin Costner.
Oh, yeah.
Director's commentary or whatever.
And in hindsight, people are going on thinking, oh, I'll have a look at it, see if it is crap. And they're like, oh,
it's all right. It's all right.
So if you watched it for 30 seconds now for the trailer on Netflix, if it just came out, is it as bad as everyone's making out? You'd give it a billion views, wouldn't you?
I bet if it was on Netflix, I bet if they released it on Netflix, it'd get, and probably is on Netflix, but I bet it does decent numbers on stream, and he's made it. But yeah, Costner moved into that realm of wanting to do whatever. He did one, The Highwayman, which is the other side of the Bonnie and Clyde story. That was about 2 hours, 20 minutes. But people watch it, people. That's probably where the streamers have benefited, that you might not watch it in one sitting, but you can make these, although the TV series are coming down to like 8 episodes, they're effectively really long form feature films.
Yes. Like Stranger Things, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not saying you're not going to sit down and watch an 8-hour movie and be like, oh, yeah, this is brilliant. But if you put it into 8 episodes.
I think we were talking before, weren't we, where it's now a thing with Netflix where you can turn it up to 1.5 times the normal play and people are watching films at 1.5 times. You not seen that?
No. I mean, it's pretty lame. But
what? So it's just fast. So you watch it
just get it into your face as quickly as you can.
Yeah.
Without digesting it. And
I had a couple of mates who downloaded Hateful Eight, and it was like a really off a Russian streaming site. It had subtitles at the bottom in Russian. I was like, don't you want to sit and watch it in like 70mm? He goes, no, I don't care. I just need to see it. I'm like, really? Okay.
Not how it's meant to be viewed.
Yeah. So why go to live music gigs? Why not just listen to cassette tapes recorded through someone's phone if you don't care? You just want to hear the lyrics. It is strange that the way people sort of consume stuff and that, but life moves on, doesn't it?
Mm. Like,
nobody was watching films 200 years ago. We don't give them any shit for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I ain't bothered, are they?
I won't respond.
No, exactly. The TV.
Yeah.
So to get back then, so again, with talking about opportunities and kind of how you network and you create those opportunities. The Birmingham Film Festival touched on it earlier. So what does that do, and what do you see doing in the future for the industry in around Birmingham?
Well, its number one job was the reason we set it up, and that was a platform for local creatives to show stuff in their hometown. It's not exclusively for local people or local filmmakers, but it was there so that people who'd made films in the region had somewhere they could get to and show it to their own community and friends and family and this, that and the other. And that worked well very, very quickly. So that's when we started expanding. Obviously, a big part of film festivals is the networking. Coming down, meeting other people who are interested in the same thing as you, got some ideas, got some networks, got some opportunities, and you can just mingle with people. And we found very quickly how disconnected all the filmmakers in the region were. And we met loads and loads of particularly writer-directors. No idea they were into the game. And then from there, it expanded into other members of crew and businesses and organisations that were also passionate about film. So we were able to grow that aspect of the festival really, really quickly to the point where after a couple of years, we don't even charge to come and watch the films. They're free to come and watch them. We got a big auditorium to watch. We got 350 seats. So, you got to be something special to fill 350 seats. With the greatest respect to short films, people don't have a habit of going out to watch short films unless they've got an association to them. So we want to make sure there's the best platform, the best opportunity for that work to be seen. But in the last particularly three years since COVID, our goal has been about connecting the industry and building careers opportunities for people so that all those passionate filmmakers who have spent their own time and money to make stuff can make a living out of doing this, and there's opportunities. So that's when we started doing conferences and seminars and workshops so that there's opportunity for people with talent to meet people who've got jobs and insight and knowledge. And that went from, and where we're pushing now is particularly the younger filmmakers, the students. So as they're coming out of college, the amount of them don't realise almost every uni in the region offers a film studies course. Coventry's got one, University of Birmingham's got one, BCU's got one, there's Film and Screen School, there's Access Creative. So if we can connect all the kids coming out of doing their GCSEs and their A-levels into higher education in film, then we're going to have this really good stream of talented kids who have got an interest in the business and they've got the skill set to, what we don't want to do, they say, go out and make your own movie. No, go and get a job.
Is that a hard thing to kind of put across? It's got feast and famine, isn't it? And it's a very personal thing. It's to be a creative, raw and right direct, make something that is yours. And then if that's not right, that's going to make me a millionaire. The disconnect then to, well, I need to find a job because I can't spend 14 hours a day doing this, making nobody because I've got bills to pay. So then you've created an infrastructure then where there are jobs within the industry.
Yeah, if you've got a day job.
You're still in the industry.
Might as well be in the industry, might.
Exactly. Mm. And you'll learn so... I know people like to build their own houses. The first house you live in is not going to be the house you build yourself. You start by putting a shelf up. And it's the same with the film industry. Don't put... Yeah, your first idea might be your greatest one. That might be the film you want to make, but you're not ready to make it yet. Don't waste your idea when you're not quite ready. Go and learn and be surrounded by people who know stuff. So when you are ready to make your film, you've got this big network of friends. You've got this big network of opportunity. You've got all this insight, all this skill and access. A friend of ours did it, went and got a job working in a camera company down in London, a couple of years down there. When he was ready to make his first film, I think he entered the London Sci-Fi 48-hour film contest. Turned to all the crew in the camera warehouse, said, you help me do this? I said, yeah, sound here's a big F off camera and all the lighting and the thing looks sick.
Who was that?
Marty, yeah. And he made a cracking film because he was surrounded by people who knew what they were doing and he'd spent time learning. So if we can, and there's so many production companies that I didn't know about, particularly in the region, the city itself is kind of sparse, like Maverick shrunk and there's a couple of other companies just sort of disappeared, particularly when the Beeb shifted a load of stuff to Manchester, we lost a lot. But that's all slowly coming back. So now our job is to get the talent that's clearly demonstrated can do stuff, whether it's younger or even, you know, some middle-aged film. We've got one filmmaker who's like 70 this year, submitted 11 films the one year. Like, puts me to shame. If we can connect the talent to the opportunities within the industry, that's just going to weave a network and a fabric of a business opportunity for those other companies to want to come down and go, you know what? We can go shoot it down there. We'll work with that company. There's loads of people. There's loads of opportunity. There's loads of apprenticeship schemes so we can get a bunch of kids on board. And the Beeb do a lot of that. The Beeb do a lot of apprenticeship stuff.
Is that it's on the Acquired Producers Forum as well, and that kind of plays into your hands with
to
that?
To a certain extent, we were a little bit unlucky. We acquired the Producers Forum like 5 weeks before the lockdown, and they just just killed it off and lost a load of membership, and we're about to build it back
seems
up.
Seems like it's buzzing now, though.
Yeah, we're getting it back up to a point again where we started out, the forum very much had the mentality that the festival had at the beginning, which is it's for the ambitious amateurs with talent to get them to that next level. And then, not to say that we've inspired loads of people, but because it has worked and because there is a track record of showing the amateur, and I don't use that word in any sort of insult, but the amateur film industry, we've shown that it exists. So now you've got things like Real Brum have set up, and there's the amateur film, the Birmingham amateur filmmakers have all sort of established, the producers forum and the festival is able to take that next step and be that link from inspired amateur to full-time career. And without that connection, this industry, probably the exception of sport, is the toughest one to go from, this is a hobby that I'm really good at, to how do I make this my job? And that's what we're trying to bridge. And the forum is a big part of that. Yeah, we've run some filmmaking contests, but our next step is network brunches with creatives to businesses who probably need, particularly, you know, TikTok videos and social media content. Well, we're bringing a bunch of businesses, playing with coffee and croissants, and go, well, there's a bunch of filmmakers who can make commercials for you. And that sustains industry and jobs and careers, and gives me an excuse not to have to do any work because I'm too busy.
No, everybody good, else. creating a whole circle, aren't you, of filmmakers, companies, businesses.
Well, it's all there.
Essentially turn it into a business thing, don't you, where you can't just be, right, I've got a dream. So that's not okay. Like you say, that advice there, where you're saying, if you have got an idea, rather than just vomit it out the first opportunity, sharpen your tools and hold on to it until you can actually
go out and shoot. You know, shoot, 100%. By all means, shoot everything, shoot anything. And
keep making stuff.
And,
and there's all those platforms to share it. I never stop doing that. I still do that. I still, I make stupid TikTok videos because I enjoy doing it. But as, in terms of a career, you've got to be savvier. You've got to get from that point where instead of handing out business cards, you're handing out invoices.
Yeah. And the problem, so I went into it with the intention of making films. The problem you've got sometimes is that chicken and eggs. You've got to earn money. So you've got to do your corporates, you've got to do your weddings, you've got to do the stuff that's going to earn you the money. And then by the time you kind of come round, you're a bit like, I'm a bit kind of tired and bit of a busman's holiday to a certain extent. You're like, I don't.
You spent all weekend carting your kit and loading your car and taking it out and
doing that thing you want to go and do.
Yeah, exactly, on your time off.
But that shouldn't be the way. You should be like, okay, it's a different form, it's a different mentality that you're doing this because you're going to do this.
Running your own
this
business
way
is tough as well. You've got to do all the admin that goes with,
especially a one-man band.
Yeah, because you're your own salesman, you're your own producer,
accountant,
everything,
marketing,
legal representation.
I always say that.
You know, you got to bow yourself
out. Harvey.
No. Only ever for fraud.
That's all right, then.
Do you know what? So, I wasn't going to touch on this, but I'd read a book called The Secret Accountant when I was on holiday last year. And there's a big piece in there about the film industry in Britain and the tax write-offs, and the films have lost 2 million.
CISOs and all that kind of stuff.
So I think I may be wrong on this. Wasn't the studio behind James Bond? I think that may, there was some kind of involvement or some kind of controversy around that. Like the game maker that makes Grand Theft Auto, they post a loss, even though it's the biggest some games.
Rockstar. They'll be Edinburgh, aren't they?
Yeah. But there's a whole like underbelly of the funding was increased to help certain production companies. And then that was taken advantage of in certain quarters. So there's a big underbelly of
some big Hollywood stars, aren't there, that have been in massive movies. And said, apparently it's never made a...
So it's,
Blade Runner's never made a profit.
It makes more money to can something you've worked on for 2 years.
It's the same as working in locations and stuff, though, all these tax breaks and this you've got to go and shoot it in Lithuania and you'll get this much off your film and you've got to do this and you've got to do that. It's all...
Made in Georgia. You see that a lot on the end of TV shows, don't you?
Yeah.
The Georgia... Peach, because they're offering tax breaks and say, all right, we've got to go and shoot X amount over here. But it happened in TV to a certain extent as well, when a certain amount of stuff had to be produced outside of London. A bunch of productions that were mid-shoot were told, right, you've got to go and you shot this in London, you produced it in London, you've got to go and do your post-production in Manchester to tick the boxes and get things. In terms of the, fudging the tax and and things. That's why they clamped down on the EIS.
There was a lot of a lot of sportsmen and celebrities that got pulled into it, didn't they, by their advisors?
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's most of them probably were just. It was like, do you want to pay less tax? Yes.
Yeah.
All right, just put your money into this. And I've known people try and sort of figure out that system, and the amount of money that. At the end of the day, you've still got to make the film. And that's hard enough. Mm-hmm. And if your film's genuinely good enough and has the potential to make profit, you shouldn't need to. Yeah, if you can save a few quid here and there by shooting in this place and your investor's money is protected using EIS or SCIS, that's great. And the tax film relief at the end of it, yeah, have that money back to help you to get across the line or this, that, and the other.
If you've got investors that are literally happy to see this film never come out, your blood, sweat, and tears are going into it, and you know in the background
they're doing it for a different reason, aren't
they? And I don't think anyone who's into filmmaking really ever buys into that as a concept. Anyone who's saying, oh, we can make this movie, it's not going to cost anything, they ain't going to end up making a movie. They're just making lines on a budget sheet.
This is where, again, isn't it, the line between business, profitability of business and creative.
You've got
the two worlds headbutting, haven't you, at that point? Where you've got a cast of crew, director, writer, everyone that wants to make this brilliant thing. From the heart, and then this way.
I think for a lot of it, it's the film industry, like the low budget film industry, is an innocent version of it where people look at, there's all these problems you've got to overcome to make a movie, there's all these obstacles. And independent filmmakers look at some of them and go, I've been able to eliminate that problem. I've got a location we can film in for 6 weeks. I've just eliminated the biggest problem. I own my own camera. So you're always trying to get over those problems so that you can make the film. If you've got money to make the film, you can get over those problems and make a movie. If you're just trying to make profit and using film as a subterfuge, and that's a completely different thing. But if you make a good movie and you get it out to an audience, it will make a profit. Anything outside of that is just trying to circumvent the requirements to make a movie, that you need a location and a crew and a budget and to pay people this and health and safety and special effects and post-production and marketing. If you're trying to circumvent that at the low-budget game, you're doing it because you've got no opportunity. You've got to circumvent those things. You're doing it at the top level and you're just trying to make money. It's a shame that that's associated with filmmaking because it's got nothing to do with it. You make a good film that people enjoy and you'll make money. Even in today's market, you make a really good film. Doesn't matter to a certain extent, provided it sounds all right. I think people are more forgiving on visuals than they are audio.
Yeah.
Especially as most people are watching it while they're on their phone. Like, they're just watching a film at the top of their head.
It's the first rule that I've...
Yeah, sound first. Yeah. And yet we really don't pay sound people. You know, everyone tries to get around it by doing it on the cheap. No. Hire a sound operator who knows what they're doing. But make a good film and it'll make money.
Yeah. So just before we wrap then, so obviously we've talked a lot about the business aspects. But as far as film goes, what is the best and worst idea for a film you've ever heard that have either been made or canned?
Oh my God.
By yourself or others, what is the best and what is the worst?
The worst idea, and I'm not going to tell you who came up with it, but the film that I know is still talked about being made amongst filmmakers I know, and it will never get made, is called Worse Than Hitler. And I'm not going to tell you what it's, but that's the title of the movie.
You don't even need the synopsis for that.
And that title hasn't changed in about 8 years, and that's still the film that is discussed, and there is no discussion about changing the title. It's how do we get the money to make Worse Than Hitler. Come up with your own synopsis for what you think that is, because I think I'd go and watch Worse Than Hitler if I saw a poster. I don't know what the poster would be, but that's where AI could be helpful, saying an actor having to dress up like Hitler. My brother put an idea to me years ago, if I only got to make one more movie in my career, it'd be this, because it was such a great idea. And I think I've mentioned this one to you. It's about a pub football team who go on holiday just before the World Cup. And then this was written before COVID, bear this in mind. And then there's an outbreak in England. The World Cup's meant to be in Spain. I shouldn't really tell people this. I've had a bunch of ideas ripped off, but I'd rather somebody made it. I got to watch it. And this pub
before football... Tom stamped this anyway, we can talk about the interview, son.
1987.
And then Pelé scores an outbreak kick.
this. Yeah. And so they go to like Mallorca or Ibiza, and their plan is to then go to the World Cup in Spain and watch England. There's an outbreak of disease. It would be COVID now. And the England team haven't left England. They're still at wherever it is, the training ground, whatever it is. And so the England team can't leave. And FIFA, I mean, we're stretching reality here. FIFA say, if you don't submit a team to play in the World Cup, you can't. So the fans can't go to Spain. The football team can't go to Spain. But this is English pub football team who have got tickets to go to Spain, and they get there and they've all got British passports, so they all can prove their nationality. And FIFA's only chance is to put this pub team into the World Cup as England's official team. I would watch the shit out of that film.
I would watch that.
Yeah, exactly.
I watched Shaolin Soccer a couple of months ago.
You could have a time there. They've struggled to get officials as well. And the only ref they can get is the worst referee in the world. Commonly referred to as worse than Hitler. Time stamp that.
He loves giving an indirect free kick. Some more ref knowledge coming out there. Probably won't put there that in.
On that bombshell. Right, thanks ever so much for your time.
No, thanks for having me. This was like I say, it was great to be on your last ever podcast.
We'll be after that last comment.
Brilliant. Thanks ever so much.
Thanks, guys. Cheers, mate. Thank you. Woo.